Welcome to the CRE Exchange Podcast, where we deep dive into the global trends and challenges of CRE professionals across all sectors of the commercial real estate industry. We engage with experts in the space to bring you innovative insights into industry practices, opportunities, and challenges to better inform your decisions. This episode is brought to you by Altus Group, a global leader in asset and fund intelligence for commercial real estate.
Welcome, everyone, to another exciting episode of CRE Exchange. I'm Cole Perry, your host and Associate Director of Research here at Altus Group, a leading provider of asset and fund intelligence. I'm joined by Omar El-Tarai, our U.S. Director of Research. Together, we'll share the latest news and trends in the U.S. commercial real estate market. We're excited to have a special guest on with us today, our first repeat guest, Dr. Stephen Buschbaum. Dr. Buschbaum provides insightful commentary and market observations on the macroeconomic and CMBS markets as the host of the Trepwire podcast. He is a real estate and finance lecturer at Clemson University. Dr. Buschbaum has published articles in leading academic journals such as Real Estate Economics and the Journal of Real Estate Finance and Economics, has presented at research and academic and industry conferences around the U.S. His research focuses on real estate finance, securitization, empirical asset pricing, and the impact of economic policy on financial markets. Stephen, welcome. And Omar, I'll kick it over to you to get us started.
Awesome. Thank you. Stephen, so happy to have you back on the podcast. It's been a year since we've hit record, but I've caught up a few times since. I know that when we had you on the podcast last time, you made a number of pretty prescient calls on what lay ahead for us heading into 2024. You spoke about the debt market trends and just the broad macro environment, catalysts really to watch out for, and you gave some really sharp predictions and set expectations for the coming year, calling out the role of geopolitics and how that would reverberate across the market, CRE liquidity being constrained but starting to get better, rising extensions and lack of payoffs. And I think you said something about how you would not feel comfortable buying low coupon bonds at the time, as well as you called out insurance and that becoming even more important and really not being solved. And then you made a pretty spot on call in terms of the delinquency rate and, you know, how to read rising delinquency rates in the securitized space and what that might mean for the overall CRE cycle. But we wanted to catch up with you not only to hear what you see for 2025, but since we're still in January, really how you would recap 2024. So welcome to the show. Super pumped to have you. And I guess we'll jump into this. Through 2024, you had the yield on the 10-year treasury rising 60 basis points, yet credit spreads really ground to historic tights. The stock market, broad market, returned about 25%. Meanwhile, REITs delivered about 5%. Corporate bond issuance was up. High yield issuance was up about 65%. And CRE securitized issuance was also up, but that was really driven by SASB and large loan issuance. But with all of that, what were you paying attention to in 2024?
Well, the big thing that has just absolutely been like wildfire on social media has been maturity defaults and the looming maturity wall. And I personally, like, maybe it's because we've been talking about this for too long at this point. I shouldn't say too long, but you know, it's been a constant 2-3 years. We've been grinding on this topic. And so I've faded the maturity wall a little bit, not to say there's not some real hurdles still that lay ahead for 2025, 26, and 27. There certainly are going to be some difficulties. But I think for me, what's going to be more important to watch going forward will be how some of these modified loans perform. If you break down or decompose the delinquency rate and what's driving it, namely, if you were to just bifurcate it into maturity defaults for loans and term defaults. And if for any listeners out there, they're like, what's the difference? So when a loan has a term default, that means it defaulted somewhere in its term prior to its balloon maturity date, right? When that lump sum comes due versus a balloon maturity, that balloon balance hits, borrower has to refinance. And when you're in a market like this, it's incredibly difficult, especially when you have banks that have, by and large, pulled back, at least on average. And so, again, getting back to decomposing the delinquency rate, maturity defaults comprise about 3/4. I want to say it's like 77% or so on average of loans that are currently delinquent, 60 plus days delinquent, including non-performing matured balloon. And term defaults, obviously, they occur throughout any cycle, but those are by far the minority. And so what I want to see going forward is these loans that have been modified for anywhere from a 1 to 4 year extension, do we start seeing those refinance and pay off? And just to give you an idea of, I think, the variety of ways in which we're going to see this, one of the recent credit stories we put out had to do with a single asset, single borrower loan that had hit its maturity date in October. It still had, if memory serves me correct, about 2 years, 1 or 2 years worth of extension options left. The fully extended maturity date was 2026. So it had one extension option left. But it seemed like the borrower was very much intent on refinancing that loan, not exercising the extension option, which to me is very interesting and part and parcel to that discussion of how conducive or how attractive is the current environment to basically term out your debt. If we think higher for longer is going to be the narrative that we'll be dealing with over the next couple of years, then what's the difference in trying to squeeze out an extra 20, 30 basis points in the 10-year? Not a whole lot of benefit to that. So yeah, I'll be paying very close attention to the modified refinance trends in 2025 as a sign of hopefully continuing thawing credit markets, and also how confident borrowers are beginning to feel about the future couple of years in CRE space.
And would you say 2024 was a clear signal to you that the CRE recovery is starting or is really gaining ground?
I think so. I wouldn't call it an absolute clear-cut signal, but I definitely wouldn't be shy in saying yes to that question. Yes, I do think 2024 showcased some of the thaw and regaining of confidence and footing. And gosh, I would say let's turn to like an MSA type example for why I feel that that's an appropriate call for close to bottom or near bottom. All right. Trying to call the timing and amount in finance is a bit of a joke. You typically get one, but not the other. So I tend to be a little bit cautious about the timing discussion. So anyway, if you look at some of the MSAs that have been the laggards over the last couple of years, namely Washington, D.C. and San Francisco, California, right? Those are two MSAs that have had a good number of headlines, not in the positive way. But you're starting to see really strong momentum, I say, have built up in San Francisco for people calling or believing very strongly that we're close enough to the bottom in office asset values to make some big plays. And that's been going on, I would say, for not just the past year, but maybe about 18 months would have been the very beginning of it. So I'm going to say about 12 to 16 months for how long that trend has been evolving. Washington, D.C., I don't know that we're there yet. So maybe 2025 is the year where we maybe start getting some clarity on Washington, D.C., which I don't think it'll come as any surprise that with the change in the administration, that will be a metro of a lot of interest this year. Curious to see what you guys think about Washington, D.C., as it fits into the broader asset cycle picture. Where are we at with D.C.?
Yeah, I mean, my quick view on D.C. is I agree with you that it'll be very exciting because you have a number of kind of competing forces, right? You have kind of the return to office. There's some real teeth to that. And I don't know, Cole, if you actually have the stat, but in terms of how much of D.C.'s office is occupied by government, it's something like
20%, but that's only directly, and then you got your independent, you know, indirect, your contractors and such. And I think the thing for me is that return to office mandates are one, but if we lop off a bunch of federal employees, that's way more powerful than forcing the existing ones to go back to the office.
Or if the government starts selling properties, right? If you really crank up the supply of properties that are on the market, I think that's going to probably not be super supportive of values, but I don't know. Maybe we'll see. But we're going to see which of those factors really kind of win out. Yeah, I don't have a strong view. All I know is that it's going to be a really kind of like fascinating interplay between those factors. But I guess hopping back to 2024, in terms of the numbers that stuck out to you for the year, what do you think were kind of the big figures to pay attention to?
Sure. So one of the big figures that I've been tracking for 2023, 24, and we'll be following in 2025 is the maturity default statistic. Or conversely, this is another study that we also look at, are payoff rates. Payoff rates can get a little bit tricky because you tend to have this issue where some loans will only extend for 1 to 3 months, but they've paid off after maturity. And so you have to make a decision as the researcher about where you set your firm line in the sand to say, was this kind of close enough to the maturity date to consider just a standard payoff? So anyway, default rates are a little bit more straightforward to track. And so to highlight where we have come from in 2023 and 2024, let's stick with everybody's favorite sector to kick around, office. In 2023, if you looked as of December 2022, the 1 year ahead, modeled maturities for 2023, approximately 20% of office loans that were scheduled to mature in that next year ended up becoming delinquent. And when I say becoming delinquent at some point in 2023, those are loans that did not either pay off or get a modified extension. We had no resolution. The status stayed as delinquent in that same year. So 20% in 2023, that actually ticked up to 22% in 2024. And the reason why I bring this up is there's so much research that gets kicked around on social media. I saw one post that was highlighting that maturity defaults weren't as bad in 24 as what was being talked about. Well, the stats for the CMBS universe would indicate otherwise for certain property sectors. Now, retail, right? That's another sector that still has a good share of delinquent loans out there. Mind you, we all have, I think, discussed this pretty heavily, and that you have to be very careful about what subtype you're talking about with retail, because the U.S. consumer is still spending. And I mean, shoot, if you look at how quick some bankrupt retail spaces have been backfilled, it's mind-boggling. It's actually a net positive for these operators. And so really, it's just the regional malls where you still have a large amount of distress playing out. But that's obviously not limited to regional malls. You've seen a couple other, either, I don't say subtypes, but let's do the intersection of subtype, geography, and property class, right? The laggards there. So you actually had an uptick in maturity defaults for retail as well. It was 11% maturity default rate in 23. That ticked up to 19% in 2024. Across the other property types, the maturity default rate wasn't that high. For multifamily, it was only about 10% in 2024. Lodging, 10%. All other property types, which includes mixed use, 5%. So what I'll be looking for in 2025 is for those maturity default rates to potentially inflect downward. I'd like to see that number start coming down. And the big number, the other big number I want to bring up here is issuance, right? Because you teased it in the intro. Pricing was very conducive to issuance in 2024. And gosh, it was like 4X plus issuance on a year-over-year basis. So we topped $100 billion in issuance in CMBS in 2024. That was awesome to see. But we're still net negative on the space. So I think 2025, what I'm tracking and doing analysis on right now is what will it take for us to hit net positive issuance? Basically, in other words, you have more loans getting issued and securitized in the space than you do rolling off. And this was a problem that we saw after the 2008 financial crisis and the 5-7 years after that, is that basically the space was ticking down or grinding down. Issuance, while healthy some years, wasn't enough to make up for the loans that were exiting the space. So I think 2025 is primed potentially to be net positive.
So I think there are two elements there that I would love to explore further. One is the kind of the deal structure and what the market seems to have appetite for. In 2024, the large loan and SASB deals really represented about half of the new issuance that we saw, which historically, if you go back kind of the last 10 years, that's kind of double the rate in terms of composition of all new issuance. So what do you think about SASB, and if potentially there's more return from conduit or agency seemed to still be a bit constrained as well on the multifamily side.
Yeah.
Do you have any kind of views of why that was in 24 and if 25 might look different?
Ooh, that's an excellent question because there's been a lot of friction in the market recently over SASB deals and their ratings, and it's been a little bit salty. So yes, if we look at the breakdown for issuance by product type or deal type, so specifically the amount of issuance that you had in single asset, single borrower deals, conduit deals, and large loan deals in 2024, SASB came in at a monstrous almost $71 billion in 2024 issuance. Now, that's compared to almost $20 billion the year prior, just over $47 billion that was issued in 2022. And the previous high watermark that still holds is 2021. That was a banner year for issuance and absolutely knocked it out of the park. We had just over $81 billion in SASB issuance that year. So 24 was very healthy, but still below our 2021 high watermark. Now, if you look at conduit, conduit has been just chugging along appropriately in the background, constantly filling that ever-present demand for CMBS allocations for bond buyers. So if you go back to 2019, over the last 6 years, 2019 still holds as the high watermark for conduit issuance, which speaks to that shift and that SASB deals, because of the flexibility you have in deal structuring, and importantly, the fact that you can get floating rate debt that gives you prepayment flexibility, that's been ultimately a very efficient product type for structuring, pricing, and it's been supported broadly. The demand has remained. So even though we've seen talk about, certainly last year, the big headline midway through the year, was when 1740 Broadway was liquidated and the AAA bonds got clipped. And there's a few more of those lingering out there where it looks like the AAA bonds will get clipped. But, you know, in the scheme of this universe, it's like half a dozen deals. So I hate when people blow this out of proportion and say the whole sector is bad. We're throwing the baby out with the bathwater trend. And at the end of the day, I step back from this and say, look, as a former bond investor, we always took ratings with a grain of salt, or in some cases, like, you know, a healthy electrolyte shot. Like, this is a marathon sector where, you know, the ratings at any one point in time are to be taken as absolute truth. It's up to all of the investors out there to put on their big kid pants, do your due diligence, and ultimately determine what you think intrinsic value is, what you think could happen 3 to 5 years in the future. How low could it go? And for how low leverage so many of these loans are and the amount of spread you get compared to conduit deals or investment grade corporates, there still is very strong argument for relative value here. So I think so long as we don't see any credit stresses materialize into weaker demand in 2025, SASB should remain on good footing. But what I want to see with conduit is we've had this ceiling of right about $30 billion in issuance going back to 2020, as I'd love to see us get to $50 or $60 billion in conduit issuance. You know, let's grind back. Now, it's going to be very tough because there's a lot of unknowns in 2025. I feel like that's the name of the game for this year is unknowns. I could paint a picture where, depending on the order of executive mandates and laws that are passed, tax reforms, right? We could have very strong economic growth, continue tightening spreads. Conversely, I could paint a picture of where tariffs is everybody's fun element to focus on, where tariffs, you know, reignite inflation concerns, bonds sell off, credit spreads whiten, and continued weakness in the sector also has some knock-on effects for new issue demand. So it could really span pretty wide spectrum this year from a scenario analysis, which makes it really interesting. If I was an investor, right, anytime you have this large of a divergence in opinion, this is when opportunity is ripe for the picking. Perhaps that's maybe the term you can lean into this year for 2025 is opportunity.
I like that. And I guess the other question I had was, because the revival of or the the reemergence of the securitized space and new issuance really does signal like market recovery. However, there's been a lot of talk around banks and non-banks, so the non-securitized financing, which banks are still out but seem to be thawing a bit. And I would say the regulatory environment seems to be warming up to or suggesting that banks are going to start coming back into CRE lending. But in the non-bank space, I know the insurers have been pretty aggressive, as well as there's a plethora of funds really out there. Do you view that as an opportunity, or is that a real threat for securitized issuance?
It could really be painted as either. Prior to the November election, when we still had, I would say that the dominant view was that the constraints in banking space were going to persist, maybe not be as bad as we'd expected because of the tweaks to Basel III Endgame and ultimately bank reserve requirements. And the unknown there is still the current scrutiny being placed around CRE loan books, especially for regional lenders. So if we were to roll back the clock, I would say CMBS definitely was viewed as having a huge role to fill and a very opportunistic role to fill for that financing gap that was left between banks, insurers, and private fund space. So right now, given how the winds have shifted, I would say maybe that represents a little bit more of a threat. Maybe if we dig a little bit deeper beneath the surface, insurance companies still have the power to pick their spots, right? They're going to be very selective, I think, continuing. Maybe in the margins, we'll see them have to get a little bit more aggressive, but because of the gap that was left from banks, insurers really were able to be fairly selective. If banks do come back to the market in stronger fashion in 2025 than what was projected toward the end of last year, that's definitely going to take another clip out of CMBS space. But again, when you think about what drove 2024 issuance, the flexibility and fairly good execution you had in SASB space, I think there's still a strong argument to be made for that to continue. And then the big question is, okay, what can conduit capture outside of that realm? And so if insurance companies have to compete a little bit more with banks, then some of that business really could be lost. But let's pivot here and look at pricing and volumes, because this, I think, paints a very good picture as far as where we could go from here starting in 2025. If we look back to 2019, with 2019 for conduit issuance, again, being the high watermark over the last 6 years, issuance was incredibly strong and spreads were really holding in there for the senior AAA bonds. They're holding in at roughly the mid to high 90s. It was approximately where they were at. And in fact, if you just look on a deal by deal basis over the first deals that priced in 2019, you were seeing the senior AAA bonds, the 30% credit enhanced bonds, getting issued right around anywhere from as low as about 80 basis points over swaps up to about 95 basis points. So if you look at where we're at today, issuance is pricing right around in that same realm. In fact, we could continue to go tighter into the roughly low 90s or even mid 80s on a spread basis. So there's still more tightening that could happen in conduit space. And importantly, I would say this is another part of my analysis. Unfortunately, I didn't have a chance to get to before this podcast, but I believe if you look on a relative value basis, CMBS still has some tightening that could happen relative to corporate investment grade corporate bonds. So if you look at comparable corporates and that historical spread difference between these two products, I want to say that there's still a little bit of juice that we could squeeze out of that spread delta between corporates and CMBS. So to the extent that continues to grind tighter and the riskier parts of the bond structure capital stack continue to tighten in, conduit will be primed. So to your question, it's really a matter of what sort of product we can source. Because pivoting back to broader issuance and property type trends, what we've seen over the last couple of years is that there is a hard cap on how much office exposure bond investors are willing to stomach. If you look across the past 2 years for conduit deals, I believe there are only three CMBS conduit deals that had office exposure greater than 30%, which prior to the COVID pandemic, it was very common for deals to have 30, 35% exposure to office. Now, if you're hitting 20%, some people are starting to sweat. And the firm line in the sand I've heard quoted is, you know, right about 25 and definitely 30% is a red line for some bond investors. It's basically an investment committee risk. And so staying in that 15 to 20% range has been what's been palatable for bond investors. So that's a pretty difficult structuring issue for issuers here because you have to make up the slack somewhere else. So for the last 2 years, retail has stepped up and been a very strong allocation here for deal issuers. Lodging picked up some as well. Multifamily is a bit funny because this is basically anything that's not going to the GSEs, the agencies. And so it's a very small percentage of the overall multifamily loan universe, but multifamily has continued to stay in there right about, let's see, 6-year average for multifamily allocations and conduit deals has been right about 14%. So this past year, we had 20.5% allocated to multifamily. So that'll probably continue to stay pretty healthy. Granted, we've seen some weakness in the margins in multifamily, but gosh, I think we have to be pretty close to absorbing that additional stock in many markets. So from here, I think there's a really good growth path that's set for rents in multifamily space. So outside of that, you have industrial and lodging. Yeah, there's only so much of that we can digest. And then you have the all-encompassing like mixed use and self-storage and some of those other property types outside of the big five. So I guess then in short, in summary, conduit is certainly primed to have another healthy year of issuance. There's going to be some competition with insurers and banks, especially if banks are able to step up their game in 2025. But we're still in the early innings of executive mandates and change in the regulatory regime. So I think it's going to be all hands on deck, all ears perked up and listening as we progress through the first quarter.
So Stephen, I'll probably cap or the first part of our conversation here with one big question. You know, we just got back from CREFC, which is just last week. And you mentioned, you know, a few comments ago that with this huge divergence in opinion on what's going to happen, could that be, you know, big economic growth due to deregulation, lower taxes, or the return of inflation? You said the word you'd use to look at 2025 is opportunity. The word or the phrase that we heard all week at CREFC was cautious optimism. It was a bit of a punchline by the time we wrapped up, but I want to hear your take on that. What you think, is there another phrase you'd use to describe how you're feeling about 2025?
I think cautious optimism is very fair. Unfortunately, I didn't get a chance to attend this year's CREFC, which I was really bummed about because I know there was a lot of fantastic discussion and it's always one of the most efficient ways to get your finger on the pulse of what all of the different players in this space are thinking and focusing on. So, you know, to hear cautious optimism was really the dominant tagline for this year. It makes a lot of sense. The way I think about the daunting task of projecting possible outcomes right now is, you know, in, was it Avengers Infinity War? I think that was the one where Doctor Strange was hovering in air, like going through the 14 million possible outcomes. That's a bit of what it feels like at this immediate point.
And they only succeeded in one.
Right. I'd like to think that we have a few more paths that'll lead to success, but it certainly is a difficult mix because, shoot, let's think about the downside risks to the space. Namely, if bond yields push higher because we have inflation tick back up. Won't even get into the possible cause of that. Let's just cut to the brass tacks here. Rates go up, cost of debt goes up, inflation's rearing its head again. And heaven forbid, then we have to start worrying about the other part of the Fed's mandate, which is full employment. Sure, there's absolutely one of those Doctor Strange scenarios out there where the value declines we've seen over the last 2 years was only the first part of a double dip. That is not my base case scenario. It's certainly It's feasible, it's possible, but I don't know what's going to break us, right? We need a trigger event ultimately for that scenario to play out, at least for me. And if we look at the geopolitical landscape right now, it certainly appears to be tilting in a more positive trajectory than it did even like 2 months ago. So these are all positive signs for me. If the consumer can stay on good footing, we don't have inflation picking back up in its material way, where we start worrying more about price hikes and we can bet more on just a hold in the rate, that's a very good base case scenario for me. And the big question for, I think, the CRE space is, what sort of tax reforms, regulatory reforms will we get in the margins that could ignite this tinderbox of opportunity to take off in a very positive direction? And REITs would be one sector where I'd be looking for the early pricing of that to happen. REITs were on the early end of value declines and value destruction for this cycle. So in theory, they should be the early signals for the turnaround. And if you look at the, whether it was from the CEO, the CFO, or any other C-suite executives from a number of REIT conference calls during earnings seasons, the last two or three quarters, there's been some really strong momentum in that space, even for office heavy REITs or pure play office REITs. Shoot, look at SL Green's commentary. It's been very encouraging. So I would like to see some of that start getting priced in, assuming the forward guidance continues to be validated by actual performance.
I know that there's been a lot of focus on kind of like the downsides or potential cracks. But if we take the flip side of that and play out the kind of the growth scenario, what do you see as kind of the positive? Is it would this be something that, you know, assuming that the consumer stays healthy, inflation is in check, and maybe rates remain steady, or we do have a few cuts this year, do you think that that would set us up for steady progress and building? Or is that, are we, you know, getting ready to rip and run?
Rip and run. I like that. I like that, rip and run. Now, you mean rip and run positive or rip and run negative?
Rip and run positive. I know that you're a debt guy, and debt folks, they are always focused on what can go wrong, right?
Yes.
You're always measuring your potential loss. But, you know, I think you've pointed out a few times that the number of scenarios of how something could play out are infinite. But what we know, changes that we are watching, some are very pro-growth, and then others are kind of, you know, inflationary, which the inflationary then feeds into kind of this cost of capital being a problem. And so I'm just curious if we can explore the positive side as well. Like, what would a positive scenario look like?
Sure. So on the macro front, to go from macro down to our micro and sector specific, what I am really excited to see play out, and as you can tell from my phrasing here, that's a pretty confident statement. But what I think we all can agree on is AI is fantastic. It's game-changing, life-changing. But the inevitable is that the efficiency gains will start getting realized at some level. And productivity tends to be a very slow-moving metric. So what we could be seeing here in the early stages, what I would like to see start to dominate in 2025, is that we have real adoption and measurable productivity gains from AI adoption. And so when you think about Econ 101, inflation, real rates, and ultimately what the Fed has to balance here, that we can have inflation tick up, but it not be damaging inflation, right? It's just growth. So if the productivity gains are large enough, then any wage gains that result aren't inflationary, right? If I can produce more work because now I have this AI co-pilot and I can get paid more, that's a fantastic outcome. From a macro standpoint, that's what I'll be looking to see, if we can finally start getting some hard and fast evidence of AI adoption and productivity gains that can help support the growth without being inflationary. That'll be really exciting to see. I don't know how much of that really could play out in 2025, but from how I see AI being adopted at a corporate level, when I talk to folks about, like, you know, are you using it? How are you using it? Has it made a difference in your workflow? And you're starting to see really that momentum pick up. And while adoption rates might be still low compared to ultimately where we're headed, I think they're still high enough to have measurable productivity gains on the margin. So turning to now what that means for CRE space, I think over the short run, it's not like jobs are going to evaporate because of AI. If anything, there could actually be a stronger growth story because we have to basically train up new labor to use AI before we can ultimately change our labor landscape and maybe become leaner on the labor front. So I think over the short run, office has strong support, at least still for the Class A amenity-rich office. And hopefully we'll start to see some trickle-down effects for the office that's been less loved. I don't think like early 1900s vintage small floor plates, old and tired office is necessarily going to benefit here. Maybe like your 1980s, 1990s vintage that is priced so cheap that if you're a startup, fantastic. We'll upgrade at some point. But right now, we need people in person collaborating to actually realize these productivity gains. So for office, yeah, I think we are hopefully close to realizing a floor. Any lease rollovers that we have over the next 2 years will be the ultimate test, right? Because this will be kind of some of the final vintages of leases that are expiring that will test what current demand is. Turning to multifamily, high rates have stifled construction permits in some areas. You're still getting, I would say, a decent enough amount of construction permits, construction starts. We hear it from everybody. We're still undersupplied. So multifamily hopefully will be close to bottoming out on the rent growth trajectory, and the supply constraints and rent growth going forward will be very conducive and will hopefully come close to, heaven forbid I say this, but, you know, equilibrium, or at least a sustainable supply and demand balance there. Outside of there, like lodging, I would say business travel is more or less back. I don't know where else we could squeeze out more business travel. Obviously, there's been a pretty big shift on the conference landscape for San Francisco, losing a good amount of business to Las Vegas. Las Vegas came out as a pretty big winner in that fight and did very well to siphon some conferences off. So outside of there, say lodging still has fairly good support, but what we'll have to deal with there are some of the old tired hotels that are ripe. They've been delaying their basically upgrade that's been necessary, refinishing the place, putting up new paint, carpet, changing out the pictures.
Yeah, they exhausted all their reserves in 2020. So you got to build them back and renovate in the mid-2020s.
Exactly. So I think that space will continue to see that healthy churn, but I don't have a strong conviction one way or another. I feel like ultimately if the economy stays strong and the growth story progresses, yeah, you'll have some very good winners. And I got to bring this up. I can't help but make this joke. I made it on the podcast a while back at this point. I think it was actually after the last CREFC. Is that if we're looking at property sectors of what could be a hedge against climate risk, I would say hotels right next to an airport could be a very good property type hedge. Severe weather disruptions that would impact flights, those are increasing in frequency and severity. That should lead to increased demand for hotel nights next to airports. So maybe that'll be one subsector to watch.
And one thing that you brought up last time was insurance. And I know insurance is like really front and center, given the horrific wildfires in LA, as well as, you know, if you go, just go through the top, you know, most costly adverse weather events in the U.S. ever, if you sort by the cost, right, a lot of them happened recently. And I know that, you know, you've brought up a number of times in, you know, I guess on the last podcast, but then in our catch-ups and just non-recorded conversations, that insurance is like very much still a problem that has not been solved. Has your thinking around that changed at all? Are there any green shoots or any hopes that you're paying attention to in that space?
So Florida would be like one of the green shoots I would call out, because you've seen premiums plateau you're not seeing those drastic, like double digits, 15, 25% increase in premiums. They've stabilized and now a lot more modest. And importantly, if you look at, say, the Florida run insurance backstop Citizens, they've been successfully depopulizing their policyholder. They've been successfully depopulizing, which basically just means that they're taking policyholders that are having to use that insurer of last resort Citizens and converting back to private markets. So you've had a number of insurers re-enter or enter that market. We want competition. You have to have competition in this market. California would be the opposite, or some crabgrass, where you've seen insurers leaving that market. Premiums continue to increase. And these wildfires are, they're probably the policy impact, the rate impact can be felt by even like you and I. It's just the magnitude is mind-boggling for how substantial, not just the direct losses, but the knock-on effects that will be felt from these wildfires. And funny enough, I'm glad you bring this up because the Wall Street Journal just had an absolutely fantastic piece they put out here in the last couple of days talking about basically, is insurance broken? This is one of the greatest financial instruments or inventions in modern history, but is it breaking down? And I would encourage anybody that is interested in this topic that hasn't read that Wall Street Journal article, make sure to go read it because it gives some really interesting, really useful background on insurance markets and specifically this question of, is the state-run, state-regulated model going to last? And to me, that's a big question. That was one I had not just last year, but it's been lingering for a couple of years now. And I could see with the change in administration and the recent losses from the California wildfires, reigniting this discussion of, all right, do we need to talk more seriously about a substantial overhaul for this sector and possibly convert from a state regulation model to a national oversight and regulation model? I could see that happening, but at the same time, that is a monstrous change not to be talked about lightly. On that front, to boil it down to the brass tacks, the short answer is sure, we'll have some green shoots in the insurance pricing and insurance renewal sector, but broadly speaking, there's a non-negligible amount of challenges we'll continue to face in 2025.
And do you see that ultimately really playing out in terms of what gets financed and the risk that somebody would look at? You know, you're always looking at location, you're always looking at the property type, you're looking at the class of property, but ultimately I think insurance is becoming a big enough issue that people are seeing that there is more embedded risk than initially viewed because there is uncertainty around getting insurance or at what cost. How does that flow through to the financing side?
Absolutely. I suspect I need to have some more discussions on this front because I am curious about how underwriting and due diligence practices have changed over the last couple of years with the rise in not just the rate increases, but basically policy non-renewals or policy cancellations. Because the number of insurers in certain markets has dwindled pretty substantially. And from a lender standpoint, if the policy does lapse, it gets canceled, not renewed, whatever, for any of a number of reasons, if the property insurance policy goes away, the lender will do what's called force place insurance. They have an insurance company that will come in and insure that property so that, say, fire happens in one of the units of a multifamily complex, the entire place burns down. The lender wants that collateral insured, has to have that collateral insured. It's a secured loan. So it's a vested interest. So anyway, getting back to my point here is that I suspect force place coverage, at the very least for lenders, is something that you're wanting to make sure how it's being priced for your portfolio footprint. And to the extent there are any dramatic changes in pricing by geography, that should be rolling into ultimately loan cost, right? Even though it might be a low likelihood of a borrower purposely or not purposely dropping, having the insurance policy dropped, that likelihood might be low, but I still need to price that as a lender at time zero into your loan spread.
Absolutely. Oh, and so I know that we're running up on time here, but just so we can have a prediction so that when we bring you back for the third time next year, would love to know what are your top two predictions for this year?
Ooh, I like it. Top two predictions. So one, I'm just going to go out on a limb here and say that we will have, for the first time in a while, net positive issuance in CMBS space. Hopefully that pans out to be correct and not the other direction. That'll be one. Let's go with net positive issuance. And then two, let's go with something distress related. I'm going to say during 2025, we see the office delinquency rate hit about 13% by mid-year. We're currently at 11. I mean, that's a pretty modest or conservative forecast. I hate to even throw out a specific number because realistically, I think we could maybe even hit 15% this year if conditions are ripe. But that's going to be my call is 2025. We'll hit somewhere in that mid-teens level for office delinquency, and that will ideally be our inflection point because, again, issuance is going to be backfilling that denominator. We'll have cures rolling out of the numerator, and we'll roll on from there. We'll see.
Awesome. Well, Stephen, thank you so much for joining us for another episode and ultimately sharing your views on the year ahead. And with that, we'll close it out and hope everybody tunes in for the next episode of CRE Exchange. Thank you.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the CRE Exchange podcast powered by Altus Group. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a 5-star review and be sure to subscribe so you never miss an episode. This episode is brought to you by Altus Group, a global leader in asset and fund intelligence for commercial real estate. At Altus, we bring together capabilities across technology, analytics, valuations, tax, and development advisory services. We are guided by bold thinking, integrity, and inclusivity, partnering with CRE professionals to maximize opportunities with exceptional service experience. Find out more at altusgroup.com.